Going to the Woods, 2015. The talk is titled, Trust the Difficult, Trust the Easy. Realizing Wisdom Within Emotions. Emotions are the central animating energy of our lives, giving us identity, meaning, motivation, the ability to care about and connect with others. For most of us, emotions are kind of the meaning of life. Stay out of the bad ones, stay in the good ones. Emotions are the organizing feature of our psyche. Apparently, when damage is done to emotional areas of the brain, people can't make decisions. You know, we think decisions is this rational kind of, you weigh the pros, you weigh the cons on both sides. Maybe you do lose-lose, maybe you do win-win, but either way, you know, it's this kind of like spreadsheet in your head. But emotions really control our decisions, our choices, our directions. Without them, we don't make choices. So this is a powerful, powerful arena for our practice. Working with the unpleasant side of emotions and the pleasant side. This is where, in a way, we taste most immediately the benefits of practice. For many people, this is where the rubber meets the road, where we really notice our practice making a difference. I mean, one of the most common things I hear in people new to practice, the main thing that they start to notice is, wow, I'm just not quite my normal self here. I'm just not so reactive. They're talking about their emotions. You know, I'm not getting quite so Twitter-baited. Kerfuffled. And then the more comfortable we get with our emotional life through practice, the less avoidant we become, the braver we become, because we can handle our lives. Well, we can handle our lives because we can handle our emotions. So this is right, you know, just like the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is right at the very fulcrum, you know, of our experience, so is the emotional life. So when we use RAIN or other approaches to working with emotions, we grow. We watch ourselves grow. When our emotions feel workable, we gain this confidence. Our life becomes workable. And the Tibetan tradition calls this confidence of my mind is workable, my life is workable. They call it the lion's roar, which is nice, isn't it? Strength, like, yeah, I can do my life. All the slings and arrows, joys and tragedies, triumphs and failures. The Buddha called all of this the vicissitudes. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and ill repute. So that doesn't stop. Awakening is not about stopping that. Awakening is making peace with that. So So tonight the talk's really about trusting our tough stuff, that there's something to be learned in all our struggles. And when we learn those hard knocks of life, then we turn around, you know, and our experience becomes useful somehow, some way, sometime to somebody else. You know, so if you've struggled with RA, rheumatoid arthritis, or nerve issues, or gastrointestinal issues, or depression, or anxiety, all of that is hard. It works us big time. But we dig deep. It makes us dig deep. And then that depth becomes someone else's benefit. And we feel good that we can be there for somebody. So trusting the difficult is important. Trusting the easy is very important because of the negativity bias of the brain, which is human, but something about being conditioned in Western culture, it makes us very individualized, which sets us up, I think, for a lot of unworthiness easily. So that's conditioned into us, and we might have a family history that has conditioned negativity, self-judgment, judgment of others into our stream. So we need to really understand that there's a kind of magnetic pull to all the negative in our lives, and we need to very much to counteract that, counterbalance that, actively seek out the pleasant, the positive, the good. So that's the talk. And so again, just to remind you, emotions, the way we look at it through the Vipassana lens, is it's essentially thought. And thought is really two types. We have verbal thinking, words, but also images. Now that's the kind of just conceiving. So emotions can be thought or images that are charged enough to have some expression in the body, including the head. Can be jaw, you know, anywhere in the body. And that's not some, you know, that's just one way of slicing and dicing reality. So it's just how I'll use the word emotion. So if there's worry, you know, worry might not show up very much in the body. It might show up in the body as a, you know, kind of a little twist in your forehead. But that might be a level, is that an emotion, is it not? Whatever, doesn't really matter. But we know when emotions are stronger, they will have a body component. So, and then there's a huge range of how we do emotions, right? Some people are just wildly emotional. Some people are pretty darn taciturn. No right or wrong. There's just how we are. Many, many emotional styles. So here's from the taciturn side. This is from the Onion, you know, the satirical paper. Headline, Father only expresses love through concern for proper tire inflation. Emotionally distant, Earl Kolchak of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, expresses his love for his 17-year-old Jessica the only way he knows how, by inquiring about the pressure of the four Firestone radial tires on her 1995 Ford Festiva. It goes on. Kolchak took his love for his daughter a step further by personally checking the tires with a handheld pressure gauge, but later felt embarrassed by the expression of intimacy. So let's love up Earl. You know, inside, that taciturn guy, you know, is a sweet, loving heart. But he doesn't do the emotions the way some of us do. So many styles for doing emotions. No way you're supposed to be. There's just the way you are. That's our practice, noticing how things are. We're not noticing how we're supposed to be. That's a weird mindfulness object. So our practice is waking up to our experience. Maybe you do emotions, but you don't think there's much sensation. Well, okay. That's your experience. So trust that. You might feel sad and not feel a lot of body sensations. Some people just don't have that as much. Okay, so the three basic categories, neutral, unpleasant, pleasant, just like we talked about last night. On the emotional side, as I said today, with neutral can be what Shinzen Young, the Vipassana teacher, calls rest in the body. And to him, rest is the absence of sensation in the body. So you might feel your body right now. And just notice everywhere in the body that there's really not much sensation going on. Let your attention just kind of be aware of an area where not much is going on. And then two questions. One, does this reflect a mental state? Yes or no? Just notice. And what is the effect of noticing the absence of sensation? Is that creating any kind of mental state? Okay, so just yes or no. Did you notice kind of any place in the body without sensation, without much? And then did it reflect any mental state or not? No. Okay. Most people are saying no. Anyone say yes?
So it's rest.
Rest. Uh-huh. A state of rest in the mind. Uh-huh. Okay. And then the second question, did noticing the absence of sensation have any effect on you? No? Yes? Yes. What happened, Hillary?
I feel more fortunate.
More fortunate?
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Because my foot is not hurting.
I see. Great. So there's some gratitude. Oh, good. A place that's not hurting. Good. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Sort of reinforced a sense of calm and comfort.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Anyone else?
I'm a dull.
Dull. Dull to the mind? Did your mind feel?
It's blah.
Yeah. But is blah like boring or is it just like, I'm fine, neutral? Okay. So for you, many of you, a lack of sensation, just this kind of neutral. So just, might neutral be calm? Just a question. Or is it not calm? Is it just neutral?
I don't think of it as anything, but reflecting on actually brings some happiness.
Ah.
Because it's freedom from suffering.
Ah. That's what I call blessed neutral. It's not drama or trauma. And that can be a relief of a sort. Yeah, and as I said last night, you know, we miss the neutral all the time. But what's the pretty common report, if you were to do this more often, you know, longer than we just did it for 30 seconds, when you focus on what just feels neutral in the body, it often has a calming influence, rest. And that's an emotion, you know. Calm is an emotion. Because there is the body component of that. It's just nothing. So there's not a lot to say about the neutral side of things, except that, you know, as I said last night, ego is definitely, neutral is choice number three for ego. You know, lemon meringue pie is definitely number one, but Tabasco is definitely better than just bland, neutral. But actually, you know, on a kind of our cellular being, we're kind of happy just being in a state of neutrality, like Peter said. So don't overlook the neutral in your experience. Our cells are kind of happy. They kind of just hum and vibrate in neutrality. Okay, just what you've been waiting for, the unpleasant side, Tabasco. So reality is begging us to make peace with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. You could say it that way. It's relentlessly, all day long, pleading with us to make peace with it. Because that's all it's giving us. It's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Our reality need is to make peace with difficulty. To be okay when there's difficulty. This would be awesome, right? I mean, this is what we're after. The difficulty we have with others, one form of that is the emotions they evoke in us. We don't like them because we don't like how we feel around them. But if we could like our difficult emotions more, we would like people more. There would be less difficult people in our lives. Our difficulty in life, you know, once our basic needs are met, you know, is our difficulty with the emotions that life is evoking in us. Our practice gives us a massive payoff when we actually, and some of you are talking about this in your group discussions, that you're surprised to, you know, see yourself in a situation that's unpleasant, but you're not going to trauma, catastrophe. You're just kind of like unpleasant. You know, sort of like Susan O'Brien and Kelsey who shook caca mud all over her. That's awesome. That's big. Once at the end of retreat, you know, I was in the manager's office at IMS and a yogi walked in and I was sitting there and the manager's good friends with her and said, how you doing? And she said, well, I'm fine. I'm just anxious. How often have those words come out of your mouth? You know? That's what we're talking about. We replace the reactivity with curiosity and mindfulness. So about our tough stuff, Rilke writes this in Letters to a Young Poet. And if only we arrange our life in accordance with a principle which tells us that we must always trust in the difficult, then what now appears to us as the most alien will become our most intimate and trusted experience. Boy, life gives you a left turn and it just feels completely alien. But eventually you get used to the path that's to the left. You never thought you were going left. And the turning is hard, the adjusting is hard. But then you go left and something different opens up that you had no idea about. How could we forget those ancient myths that stand at the beginning of all races? The myths about dragons that are transformed at the last moment into princesses. Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act just once with beauty and courage. Ah. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest essence, something helpless that wants our love. Wouldn't that be something? You know, some of you have talked about befriending fear. Isn't that something? What if our fear is something helpless that wants our love? What if our shame, our embarrassment, our vulnerability, you know, is something helpless that wants our love? It looks like a dragon. But when we get close and we're not overwhelmed by dragon breath, it's something helpless that wants our love. It's so beautiful. All right, this will change the gears a little bit. Another little perspective on our difficulty. A writer's brain is full of little gifts, like a piñata at a birthday party. It's also full of demons, like a piñata at a birthday party in a mental hospital. The truth is, it's demons that keep a tortured writer's spirits alive, not Tootsie Rolls. Sure, they'll give you a tiny burst of energy, but they won't do squat for your writing. So treat your demons with the respect they deserve. And with enough prescriptions to keep you wearing pants. Colin Neeson. My wife's a writer. She throws me all these little tidbits. So yes, our difficulty serves a purpose. And the more conscious we become, you know, the more our difficulty makes us dig deeper. And digging deeper is good, because then you find something a little more reliable for your happiness. You find out who you are more, and you find something like Dharma. You know, how many people in this room suddenly realized how happy you were and decided you just had to learn to meditate? Definitely not me. I was a miserable little college junior. You know, when we dig deep, then we find something that's going to point us at our own heart, you know, our true home, our refuge. One Tibetan teacher, Geshe Gyaltsen, said, "Think of your difficulties as a miracle performed by the Buddhas to get you to practice." Sneaky, sneaky. Fierce teacher. So what is that's kind of like cruel to be kind, right? So when we find purpose in our difficulty has meaning, and we bear it much better. So let you know, just reflect on that, that today's struggle in some weird way will be tomorrow's gift to someone else who hasn't traveled that path yet. You know, that's one way to ennoble your pain. And then this other way is like, it's a pointer. Our difficulties are pointers to developing a spiritual life. And you know, as we get old, what are we going to have left, you know, but a spiritual life? We have to let go of our bodies, our minds, our faculties. Some of us, you know, in group were talking about letting go of abilities and how painful that is. All of that is a pointer. I mean, the Buddha called a body falling apart a heavenly messenger. Go figure. Why can't we have these little angels on clouds and cherubic with little wings and harps and light? That's not a Buddhist angel. Darn it. Maybe you should try centering prayer. This trouble we have with our bodies and with our minds, they're actually pointers in digging deeper. They are heavenly from that perspective. And the Buddha did not mess around. You know, life is short, life is for keeps. Get real. And that's kind. It's kindness. You know? Like the poem last night, walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. So your difficulty has meaning. It's not for naught. It's not just the dumb old, oh, not this again, you know, that we're used to doing. So, that's the little pep talk part of it. And just to come into the nuts and bolts now. And, you know, I guided us in the RAIN approach, which was developed by Michelle McDonald, the Vipassana teacher. Have you sat with Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She teaches here. And she's a long time teacher, one of our teachers. Lovely woman. So she developed this little strategy, this way of being mindful. And the essence of this approach is wisdom. It's a wise, kind relationship with our emotions. It's like a grandparent, you know, with a child who's having a little tizzy. The grandparent, you know, if they're at all conscious, isn't going to say, oh, there, you're fine. You hear that, right, sometimes. But no, it's going to be like, oh, what's wrong, sweetheart, you know? There's a kind of affectionate interest. And that's the attitude we want with ourselves, with our emotional life. But the grandparent isn't swept away. You know, yeah, the plastic shovel broke. And you're playing in the sandbox at the beach or whatever, sand at the beach, and the plastic shovel broke. It's not a tragedy. But you're not going to tell that to the little child. You're just going to help do what needs to be done. So RAIN, you could think, so one teacher likes to call it RAIN deer, to bring in the affection piece. RAIN deer. So the essence of RAIN is with any emotional state. If you would, just go to some state you've been struggling with a little bit this retreat. Don't go to your maximum one. Go to something that's just in the kind of, you know, unpleasant but not a disaster realm. So with this state, are you there? Just nod if you are. Can you trump that up? I'm seeing a couple of nods. Okay. Now apply this little maxim. Accept it more. Believe it less. How does that land? Whatever this difficulty is, accept it more, believe it less. Anyone want to respond? Please.
By accepting it more, it feels that it has less of a persistence. Oh, okay, we're cool.
Oh.
Otherwise, it keeps coming back. So it's accepted.
So just to accept it makes the state dissipate. And what about the believe it less part? Is that even necessary, or?
You just be the frosting on top.
Yeah, okay, the frosting on top as it's sort of dissipating. Anyone else?
The believe it less part almost feels like permission to relax. If there was a relaxation, it's like, oh, okay, there's permission to believe it less and relax with it.
Good. And we can accept it because we don't believe it. The way a grandparent knows that the child who literally thinks his life is ended because the toy shovel broke, the grandparent knows in a few minutes that kid's going to be just fine, right? So for that reason, the grandparent can let the child have a little tantrum. So exactly, we can accept it more when we believe it less. Uh-huh. Anything else? Uh-huh.
I was going to say, don't identify with that belief, right? Don't reinforce it.
Yeah. Yeah. So don't identify with that belief is the comment. Exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of tricky because the accepting of more, it's like, what is the kind of I? And accepting more could feel like, oh, yeah, it's mine. But believe it less is that it's not mine.
Uh-huh. Both are true. It is.
It's easy to get caught in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just let me see if... Is that enough or is there more? Yeah. Yeah. Accepting it... You don't have to, like, link it to I to accept it. But it's easy for that to happen. It's just fully allowing that it's here. The way we fully allow a bird sound or fully allow a rock to be there sitting in a field. We want to be that allowing. But it doesn't mean it's mine. It doesn't have to. But even if it does, like you say, the believe it less can undercut it.
It's all true. I mean, what resists, what you resist persists.
Yeah.
So accepting it actually.
Yeah.
Stop resisting it.
And what you allow takes a bow. Sure.
I just wanted to know why you said, you told us to go to an emotion to practice this, and you said don't go to one that's too...
Yeah. Just because of right now. Just for the purposes of right now. This is just a little exercise. I don't want to activate anybody into anything too unpleasant. Yeah.
The reason I ask is that I could imagine really powerful emotions, like actually resenting myself if I tried to do that, because I would feel like I was telling myself not to believe I deserve to have the feeling that I have.
Yeah, and I understand that. It can be interpreted that way, but when we really understand, accept, this is what Jack Kornfield likes to say. To this emotional state, instead, I like to say, of course, for the accept. What he likes to say is, how big can it get? How's that for permission? That's what we're talking about. Now, when I say accept it more, believe it less, I'm saying accept the fact of your state. It's here. Jack has popped out of the box, you know, to try to deny that is foolish. So acceptance, kindness is a reality. You know, we're in touch with reality when we're kind because we're just allowing what is. So we want to really allow what is. The not believing it part is related to the story that you're telling yourself. This is where you need a little bit of a we'll see attitude. We'll see. That's a grim parental kind of thing. You're not patronizing the grandchild. You're just saying, okay, we'll see. You know? We'll see. That's a very, it's a little bit like the don't know. So our stories, we know this from our practice. We weave so many desperately intricate, painful stories. And we believe them. And it's very problematic to believe them. So we want to really allow it. We want to acknowledge the story. But we also want to know that, you know, this isn't the end all and be all what I'm saying to myself right now. I want to unpack that a little more, but did you?
It almost seems that by accepting it, you take away its energy. Because you're not fighting anything somewhere inside of you. And then when you do bring it in, you can almost, like you said earlier, feed it with kindness or feed it with love.
Yeah.
But it's within your grasp.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So when we accept, you know, we can, you know, our resistance is like the underground spring that feeds the thing. And so when we accept, we kind of relax the resistance. And then that somehow, in some weird way, can. It, you know, it's not foolproof, but often, you know, there's a softening that happens. So one last one, and then I'll keep moving here.
I just want to give you a live one.
A what?
A live one.
A live one.
Sorry, this isn't true, but let's say that I'm in love with my boss's wife.
Okay.
And I'm really trying to resist that because that looks like big trouble.
Yes.
I wish I accepted more.
Yes.
What am I afraid I'll get overwhelmed by it and something bad will happen?
Well, accept it more and believe it less.
Well,
you want to accept the fact that we're all in silence together, so you'll never know. You want to fully allow the longing. That's yours. That has nothing to do with your boss's wife. That's the object of the longing, but the longing is yours. You want to fully accept the longing. The disbelieving part is like, really? Is that true? Huh. We'll see. We'll see. But what I do know is, oh, this heart is tight with the longing or whatever the experience is, you know? Or maybe you're just awash in, you know, puppy love. But you know, that's yours. And so accept that. We want to deny it, but, you know, we think it's dangerous. But, you know, with mindfulness, we can realize there's a gap between a feeling and a behavior. They're not the same thing. There's a feeling here, and then there's an emotion. In between, there's a gap. And we have choice when we're mindful. So with mindfulness, we get to allow our emotions much more than we otherwise would. Because we have this kind of protection of our practice. I'm going to let this one rip. You know, I'm going to, inside my head, say the thing that I would never say out loud in person. Because I have the safety of my practice. I have the protection of my practice. So energetically, you get to really let anger move. But don't believe it. Don't believe it so much. I'm a little bit out of order. I want to just kind of bring myself back at least I'm going to make sense. So, but I'll get back to that point. It's called brain sprain. So don't let me forget brain sprain. When you're really activated in a big emotion, you're in brain sprain.
Brain what?
Brain sprain. You are, your brain is actually crippled. I'll talk about that. Okay, so let's kind of go through the rain a little bit, which we've done. So I just to say a few things I didn't say in the guiding. So the recognize, we know, the accept, again, is this very important thing. The first two steps, recognize and accept, is the start of a relationship with our experience. If we're just lost in it, there's no relationship. We're just, you know, we're just being run by it. So the acceptance is huge. And, you know, a great example of where accept really is powerful is with the mind state of fear. Because we get scared of our fear. Fear is avoidance. And then we don't want to feel the fear, so we want to avoid the fear. So there's something we want to avoid, and then we don't want to think about that something because we don't want the fear that comes when we do. So it's avoidance of avoidance, or fear of fear. You know, and fear of fear is still fear. So Woody Allen said, I don't like fear, it scares me. And you've probably heard that the most common fear for people is not fear of death. You know what it is? Yeah, fear of public speaking. Seinfeld says this, fear of public speaking greater than the fear of death, is that right? That means at a funeral you're better off in the coffin than giving the eulogy. So we're scared of our fear. This accept, if you say of course to your fear, wow, that's big. That's a big change. Can we do that? You have to know this about fear. It's future thinking. If you want to pare down what fear is, it's imagining the future, and it ain't pretty. It's unpleasant future thought. That's what fear is. And we need to really allow the fear while not believing the thoughts. The fear wants us to think, I'm Mr. Psychic and I know everything, and we're so convinced that scary thing is actually real. We don't know we're thinking. When we realize we're thinking, it's like, ah, future unpleasant thought. You need to say that to yourself about fear. And then notice what you can know. What you can know is right now, this is what's happening. There's future thinking, and there's fluttery in the belly. Where should we park our attention? The future thinking or the flutter? The, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm going to have that job interview. Or flutter, flutter. Which is going to be easier? Flutter. 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 Some more flutter. Hey, how about a little more flutter? Oh, there's a real nuance coming up. Flutter. That's how complicated the body is. So it's a good refuge. And that's why we say in the investigate step, your emotion, the sensation of the emotion is where to park your attention, because it's not all the drama and trauma. So the key with any difficult state, and we're just using fear here, is turn towards it. Allow it. You're the kind grandparent who's not swept away because you've got mindfulness. You can be kind to that little fear inside you. So that's why, for me, this phrase, of course. Of course. When you're scared, of course. Even when you're ashamed, of course. When you're embarrassed, of course. When you're crying, of course. It's powerful medicine, this acceptance. And this acceptance is kindness. We need kindness. We can't be with the tough stuff without kindness. We just have to be kind. And here's what Pema Chodron has to say about kindness. When people start to meditate or to work with any kind of spiritual discipline, they often think that somehow they're going to improve, which is a sort of subtle aggression against who they already are. It's a bit like saying, if I jog, I'll be a much better person. She had just been to Boulder. If I could only get a nicer house, I'd be a better person. Also just been to Boulder. If I could meditate and calm down, I'd be a better person. Another Boulder thing. But loving kindness, Maitri, in Sanskrit it's Maitri, in Pali it's Metta. But loving kindness towards ourselves doesn't mean getting rid of anything. Really? Maitri means that we can still be crazy after all these years. We can still be angry after all these years. We can still be timid or jealous or full of feelings of unworthiness. The point is not to try to change ourselves. Meditation practice isn't about trying to throw away ourselves and become something better. It's about befriending who we are already. That's it. The ground of practice is you or me or whoever we are right now, just as we are. That is our practice. We have to be kind. If we're kind to ourselves, what are we kind to? We are kind to this right now, this experience, because that's all we got. This step is really important, being kind to ourselves. You know, we're hard on ourselves, aren't we? Yes? No? Sort of. Some of us, we come pre-disapproved. Like in 2008, when the economy was so bad, the joke goes, I got a credit card offer in the mail. It was pre-declined. And during that time, I went and bought a toaster oven and they gave me a free bank. We're very judgmental. Comedian Wendy Liebman says, I was invited to the 30th reunion of my preschool. I didn't want to go because I put on like 100 pounds. So kindness, how important is it? It's so important. We can't do this mindful path without kindness. And lightness, you know, humor. Here's just one little humor story about a teacher named Son Sanim or Sung San, who was a Zen master from Korea in Providence. And he folded laundry as part of his living, and then he was a full-fledged Zen master. And he had a little bit of a fierce compassion side. He also had a very funny side, and his whole, you know, he would exhort his students, you know, when you breathe, just breathe. When you walk, just walk. You know, when listening, just listen. So in his zendo where other students lived, a student came down one day and saw him eating his breakfast and reading the paper. And the student was appalled and said, you know, Master, what are you doing? It's, you know, you're multitasking or whatever. And Son Sanim said, when you eat and read, only eat and read. Or so the story goes. So lightness and humor, but kindness. So this accept piece is very important. And then, boy, there's a lot to unpack. So the investigate piece, where is our attention? In the midst. If you're crying and you're being really mindful with the rain approach, where would your attention be? What would you be noticing? Where would you ground your attention?
Tears.
Yeah.
In the chest,
sure.
In the
Do you think that's possible?
Yeah.
Good. Wake up inside the state. We wake up inside the wetness of tears, constriction of chest. We can do it. We can be mindful and cry. We can be mindful and sad. We can do it. but we ground our attention in the sensations. And then we don't get swept away. Wetness, you know, is manageable. So we do this with investigate. And when we do this, we start to have insights, because we start to actually be witnessing our experience in a tough place. And one of the main insights you have is the insight of impermanence. I mean, no mind state lasts very long. If we keep feeding it and keep feeding it and keep feeding it and keep feeding it, it'll last. But even if you track something like anxiety or depression, you're going to see fluctuation in it. There's going to be coming to calmness and maybe going back to anxiety. Things move. And when we get out of the way and we stop resisting and start welcoming, allowing, without getting hooked, without believing, then, you know, everything kind of gets metabolized. And our emotions start to actually solve themselves. We experience anxiety and we realize there's unpleasant future thinking, and we're just with flutter, flutter, tingle, tingle, you know, and then there's more future thinking, but we stay with it, we see it, we come back. It has a way of metabolizing, getting metabolized. And all by itself, it can dissipate. And this is awesome when we have this experience. We start to realize, oh, wow, my mind is workable. I don't have to do that much. I just really, what I have to do is outlast it. I don't have to change it. I just have to outlast it. And that's what we can do. And that's powerful. We watch our mind become much more workable. The more we see that, the more we can really start allowing our tough stuff. And the more we allow our stuff, the more we just kind of sift and shake and become much more ourselves, much realer to ourselves, much more genuine. We're not defending against, we're allowing, and it strengthens us. So this is a very important insight to watch an emotional state change all by itself. Okay. So I wanted to come back to brain sprain. So when we're in this investigate place, we have insights. One of them is, you know, the impermanence of emotions if we're not feeding them. The second is brain sprain. And how many of you know about the amygdala? Okay. A lot. You know, it's thought to be some kind of organ of survival where our neuronal pathways are shunted away from our frontal cortex, where our thought centers, where we can see possibilities, and we're just in more primitive brain. And in primitive brain, the thoughts are very simple, like run or fight or something. And probably, you know, in our evolutionary past, that had survival value. We didn't want to sit around, you know, wondering if that saber-toothed tiger bounding towards us, you know, is a juvenile female or a full-grown male. You know, we became tiger food. No genes passed on. So apparently we were selected to have this strategy of our brain to actually get very primitive. So when we're in a really, really activated state, the amygdala gets activated. It shunts our neuronal pathways away from frontal cortex. We can only think very simple thoughts. What a jerk. Or what's wrong with me? Or something very simple. And we get locked in. That's brain sprain. The worst time to believe your thoughts is in the grips of a really strong emotion. I'm talking on the difficult side. A really strong, difficult emotion. The amygdala is really, literally putting you in brain sprain. So with mindfulness, if we can weather the storm and we can hang out and keep feeling our experience, the emotion releases, the discharge happens, and the amygdala unlocks, and suddenly there's more possibilities than just jerk. So the believe it less is really important when you're really mad, really scared, really ashamed. We're really in very simple brain. A lot more to say, but I'm going to gloss through it all. The non-identification piece is the one that trips people up in rain. And that just comes more as an insight. You get it that, oh, if the flutter is only in my belly, it doesn't make sense to say I'm scared. If the rest of your body is in a state of calm, saying I'm scared is fiction. It's much better to say there is fear or fear is happening. Or if you have to be more wordy, a part of me is scared. But that's not me. That's the non-identification piece. And then with the non-identify, we can let it keep happening. It's just experience that we're paying attention to. We're not being swept away. Okay, so that's the unpleasant side. I don't want to miss the pleasant side because it's important. We need to trust the difficult, but we also need to trust the easy. We need to trust and deepen what's going well in ourselves. And, you know, I've talked a fair bit about this last night. You know, our wise relationship to pleasure is, what's the word? Anyone remember? An unattached relationship with pleasure is
enjoyment.
Exactly. But enjoyment is not like, you know, I can't, you know, bear to be without this. This completes me. This can't change, you know. This is the happiest moment of my life. Oh, my God. You know, it's like, no, nice. Nice, right? That's a balanced relationship. So we don't want to fight reality. Pleasure is very important. It motivates us, keeps us going. And, you know, the theory of Buddhist practice is through mindfulness we transform our difficult states, and that all that's left behind is the inner Dalai Lama. So it's like Michelangelo chips away everything that isn't David. Mindfulness chips away everything that isn't your inner Dalai Lama or your inner Buddha. It leaves behind a lot of pleasant emotions, love, joy, compassion, empathy, etc. The tough stuff gets purified through mindfulness. Relaxation. You know, it's so pleasant. And relaxation is, you know, basically the awakened state, but it's sort of imperturbable relaxation, unconditional relaxation. On the intro to 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, the translator Garma Chang says this: all pains and desires are of a tense nature. But liberation, in contrast, is another name for perfect relaxation. Dominated by long-established habits, however, average men find it most difficult, women, most difficult, if not entirely impossible, to reach a state of deep relaxation. So instructions and practices are needed to enable them to attain such a state. And then he's talking about this practice, Tibetan practice of Mahamudra. The primary concern of Mahamudra, therefore, is to instruct the yogi on how to relax the mind and thus induce in him the unfolding of his primordial mind. So relaxation, you know, it backs you into awakening. Not kind of dumb relaxation, you know, real relaxation, really relaxing the mind. And I described how when we're mindful of the pleasant, we both enjoy it more. It's the win-win. We enjoy it more and we're less attached. So really want to be on the lookout for the pleasant stuff and really get curious. Do rain. Get really in there in the body. When you're happy, how does your body feel? Really get to know it and recognize it and accept it. That won't be that hard. Say, of course, when you're happy. And investigate. Be in the body. Really feel it. How much of you, how much of the body is in this state of happiness? Really, really see that. You know, and some of you in discussions have talked about, you have these experiences of joy and opening, and then something in you gets shy or resistant or hesitant. You know, we have to kind of actually sometimes get over being happy. You know, actually, like, get used to it. Really enjoy it. Don't feel guilty for a nanosecond, because the world needs your happiness. It isn't selfish. It's our birthright. The happier you are, the more you help. So the world needs your happiness. It's very, very good. Yes. We want to really enjoy it. And, you know, you might not like this, but with non-identify, instead of saying to yourself, I'm happy, say, there is happiness, or happiness is happening. That's you being less attached. We can shy away from these experiences of joy. You know, it can be scary in a way to be really joyful because you might lose it. It's very intimate in a way to admit the full depth of our joy. But get used to it. Very important. So here's a poem on this topic of sort of shying away from, you know, real positive energy. It's called I Confess by Alison Luderman. I stalked her in the grocery store, her crown of snowy braids held in place by a great silver clip, her erect bearing radiating tenderness, watching the way she placed yogurt and avocados in her basket, beaming peace like the North Star. I wanted to ask, what aisle did you find your serenity in? Do you know how to be married for 50 years or how to live alone? Excuse me for interrupting, but you seem to possess some knowledge that makes the earth turn and burn on its axis. But we don't request such things from strangers nowadays. So I said, I love your hair. That's our embarrassment, right? When we see something magnificent. So yeah, we need to get used to our positive stuff. Really, it's a really good discomfort to have. Go for it. So there's a whole side of positivity, gratitude, sympathetic joy, appreciation, enthusiasm, passion, interest, love, kindness, compassion. So you actively look for it and show up for it. Notice what it's like when you're on the plus side of the column. So I'll just end with one of the most famous haikus. This is a gratitude haiku. In the Japanese world. It's by Ryokan, and he was in the 17th or 1700s, 1800s. He was the abbot of a monastery, but he didn't like all the encumbrances, so he just kind of became a beggar, fool, monk, renunciate who lived in a hut. I think it was Mount Kagami, maybe, that he lived near. And he played with kids all day, and he begged for food, and he was deeply wise, Zen practitioner. But he owned almost nothing, but he came back to his hut one night, and his meager belongings were gone. And this was his response. He wrote a little poem. The thief left it behind, the moon in my window. How's that for gratitude? How's that for the cup is half full? So may that be an invitation towards your positivity. Let's sit for a minute.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.